I'm Catherine Gunn, and I worked at GCHQ as a Mandarin linguist and analyst in 2001 to 2003, and I blew the whistle on the NSA memo that was basically asking for GCHQ's help to spy on UN Security Council delegates in order to be able to influence them on the vote which would authorize the invasion of Iraq. And I leaked that, and I got charged with breaking the Official Secrets Act, and eventually they dropped the charges against me. I saw a very brief clip of the inside of the House of Commons, where a few MPs were gathered by the door, and the Speaker of the House was sitting there. And the entire episode, it was only a few minutes, but it was pretty repulsive, really, to watch them cheering and jeering. And they sounded like, and they looked like, when I watched it, a bunch of prefects in a private school gathered in their junior common room, basically chortling over something. I was pretty appalled by that behavior following one of the brutal murders of one of their own so recently. How on earth could they possibly be in such high spirits, cheering and making these kind of jokey, laughing expressions about extending these emergency powers?
Well, there was also the section of where the deputy speaker actually asked for a vote, where they say the ayes have it, and then they say the noes. I think it was an MP who was actually in the shot was chanting yes or shouted yes in the middle of the noes, obviously drowning out the noes. So that quite clearly is a breach of procedure, where you would have hoped that any decent chair would have called for a revote of some sort. I think this is where, Catherine, where they what they do is they just have a kind of shout, a bit like when the unions all stick their hands up, and you can get a general opinion of what's going on in the meeting through just the sheer number of people, and then they may have a formal vote if it's obvious that it's finally split. But anyway, the idea that you can just shout over the opposition, I thought was incredible, and there should have been some sort of acknowledgement that the MP that was murdered on Friday would have been one of the lead speakers in that debate.
Yes, well, that is also something which has created a sort of concern in me as well. The fact that he was killed so soon before, and it's pretty apparent that Lamus was also somebody who was actually very concerned about the abuse of powers by the Coronavirus Act. So it's, yeah, the whole that there's a big, there should be a big investigation into his murder. Because according to what was revealed in the press and which was covered by UK Column News, they said that an air ambulance crew attended the scene not as rapidly as normal, but it was there within 20 minutes or so. But then they didn't transfer him to hospital within the golden hour. Everybody knows that in traffic accident cases and those sorts of emergency situations where people need to be immediately in hospital for treatment, there is this so-called golden hour where if you don't manage to get any treatment, then your chances dramatically decrease in surviving. And the ambulance crews, they were there on the scene for over 2 hours. What were they doing for 2 hours? Why didn't they immediately transfer him to a hospital? I mean, those sorts of questions need to be asked. We need deep investigations into what actually happened and who this man was that is being accused of doing it, and what are his connections. And, he was part of apparently this PREVENT program. He'd been flagged up. So we know that the PREVENT program, Mark Curtis has also in his book, the book about how the state of the UK is actually working hand in glove with extremist groups within the UK and fomenting the extremism and the hate in there in order to achieve what they want, which is, you know, this concept of these terrorist cells within the UK so that they can clamp down. They're giving an excuse for them to continue to have a job for internal security. We need to clamp down on these extremists among us because...
Well, I think, sorry, Catherine, but I think the book you're talking about is Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam.
That's right, yeah. That's the one, yeah.
I think there's something, just if you don't mind me interrupting, that is a little bit similar to the death of Princess Diana, because there was also a lot of comment at the time and afterwards and at the inquest, etc., about the length of time that it took for her to be taken to hospital. And again, it was nearly 2 hours. You would have thought that in that sort of situation, it would have been fairly simple to get an ambulance to the church and get him to hospital rapidly.
Of course. And I think the same, if I'm not mistaken, I think the same occurred in Jo Cox's murder as well. She wasn't rushed to hospital either. So all of these murders raise a hell of a lot of questions.
Well, they're political murders, I think probably more correctly called assassinations, really. I mean, if it's a political murder, it seemed strange to me that suddenly there was this is terrorism. The Essex police were very swiftly moved out of the way for Neil Basu, who was the boss of Wayne Cousins, by the way, the murdering policeman. That West Essex police are swept out of the way and in come counter-terrorism command.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I think, you know, independent journalists and investigative researchers need to keep their eye on, because there's just so many holes in the narrative, as usual, about these cases.
Okay, well, what about the idea of renewing this Coronavirus Act? Because that seemed to just sort of go through on the nod, as we said at the start. Well, what about the effects of that?
It didn't surprise me that it went through, to be honest, Tony. I mean, there's been no effective parliamentary scrutiny and challenge of these things. It just seems as though they've kind of accepted that it's going to carry on till March 2022, and so be it. I just want to bring up a research paper that was released in August of this year. It's available on ResearchGate. It's by Dennis Rancor, who, as you may know, he's been accused of being a bit of a skeptic, as it were. He and a couple of other individuals researched the Canadian all-cause mortality figures from 2010 to 2021. And their conclusion was that there hasn't even been a pandemic in Canada. And in their actual paper, they quote Peter Doshi, who has stated previously that there are two main points that you have to consider for a viral respiratory infection. And the two key points, according to Peter Doshi, is that one, it occurs everywhere, irrespective of state or jurisdictional boundaries, presumably because there is no prior immunity. And two, it causes excess mortality, far greater than that due to non-pandemic seasonal viral respiratory disease epidemics. So those are the two defining characteristics of viral respiratory diseases, VRDs. But they go on to state that one problem in practice is that VRD class mortality is difficult to quantify. The actual number of VRD attributable deaths is always uncertain, especially when the deaths are counted in the context of a media frenzy about, quote, the pandemic. This is as true today as it was when epidemiology was a nascent science, because a cause of death determination with many cofactors and in the absence of an analytical autopsy is prone to human error, human bias, institutional bias, and even constructed bias, as we have seen in the COVID period. So they've concluded, Tony, from their research that Canada did not actually experience a pandemic. What actually happened, and they state this, is that the key notable anomalies of this so-called pandemic was that predominantly the most elderly, people over the age of 85, died from the immediate response to the pandemic, which was announced by the World Health Organization on the 11th of March, 2020. And I think you can see that pattern repeated across many of the centers of mortality. So we saw that initial spike in mortality in New York City. We saw it in the UK. We saw it in the north of Italy, in Belgium, and so on. I think those were the main areas where there was a sort of, in the March, April period, a lot of very elderly deaths, you know, deaths in those who are over the age of 80 and who had comorbidities and who in the main were either in hospital or in care homes.
Hang on, because what you're saying there is that actually it was the institutions charged with looking after our health that led to so many people dying.
Yeah, so in their research article, they go into the fact that the deaths were caused by the response. It was the government responses to this announcement that there was a public health emergency by the WHO. It was that response by governments which led to the deaths of these elderly people. And in the UK now, we have a number of individuals who have been sending out copious amounts of freedom of information requests since at least August, if not sooner, last year, to all kinds of authorities within the UK. First of all, there is a chap who's done a lot of this, a guy by the name of Mark Oakford, who sent out over 1,000 freedom of information requests last year to all the civil service sectors in the UK, asking how many of the staff working for them died as a result of COVID. And, you know, that information came out in alternative media. Of course, it was never broadcast on any of the old mainstream media channels, but the mortality rates were far, far lower than anything that was being discussed in the mainstream. So, you know, based on millions of staff and the results from his collating the data, over 684 replies he got from his over 1,000 requests, the mortality rate was something like 0.0077.
Yeah, but I mean, hang on, because most of those people, of course, were, well, all of them pretty much will be below retirement age and therefore not people who are most vulnerable to COVID.
Right. But I think you could argue that in that, the numbers of people covered by the civil service are vast, right? The people who are employed. And he sent it out to Wales, Scotland, and England. So he got all the different areas. And, you know, you have sort of a mix of age groups between ages of, you know, 18 and let's say 65 retirement age, and huge ranges in ethnicity and in as well overall health, including the police, including the ambulance. The numbers of people who passed away in those age groups are, like I say, that it was 0.007.
Well, I suppose the point you could make is that all these people have been persuaded to have vaccines where actually it doesn't look as if they were vulnerable.
Well, indeed. Yes. And then, of course, there will be a lot more research now to compare from last year to this year and how their health, you know, and I think the outcomes are not good. I mean, they've already come out with research that's looking like for the younger, much younger cohorts, already it's showing that children between the ages of 16 and 25 or perhaps even younger, the incidence of heart and bad health outcomes, the mortality is 25% higher already. So it's looking like what I'm trying to say is that because they changed the definition of pandemic fundamentally back in 2010, taking away the actual definition.
So when you say they, who do you mean? The British UN, the WHO?
The WHO. I don't know if many people are aware of this. It's been repeated many times in alternative investigative media. But back in 2010, the World Health Organization removed key characteristics of a pandemic definition by saying it only has to be a disease, a new disease, that spreads widely across many countries. And they removed the fact that it had to cause a lot of serious illness and great numbers of death. They removed those two things. So it doesn't have to cause serious illness, doesn't have to cause a lot of death. It just has to spread widely and be a novel disease. Now, that's basically what happened. We had, as Wolfgang Wodarg, the doctor and politician who exposed the swine flu pandemic back in 2009 and 2010, what happened back then is what is happening now, except fourfold, tenfold. It's on a much grander scale. And he's been repeating the same thing that he said back in 2010. Now, you know, it just appalls him. There's a new interview with him on the Planet Lockdown podcast. So that's just gone out recently, where he's talking about all of these things. So this brings us back. So if we consider the possibility that actually there has been no pandemic, there's been no massive increases in all-cause mortality, and I think that has been proven. Last year, there were no massive increases in all-cause mortality. So then what is the point of these emergency measures? These emergency measures of Coronavirus Act, which they passed in March last year, were implemented. I'm looking at the actual renewal of temporary provisions document. It says they were implemented to enable the government to respond to an emergency situation and manage the effects of the pandemic. The Act aims to support government in doing the following. Now, these are the five key areas that the government claims the Coronavirus Act allows them to protect the population and to support them. So firstly, number one, increasing the available health and social care workforce. Well, I think what we found was, as people within the healthcare industries and in the nursing homes were forced to take those PCR tests and rapid antigen tests from the beginning for the last 18 months, that has had a serious impact on workforce numbers in both the nursing homes, care homes, and in the hospital sector. So that's just one aspect of it, the pingdemic, you know, the testdemic. So they've actually done the opposite of what they started out, what they claimed the Act would allow them to do. Number two, easing the burden on frontline staff. So obviously that goes back to the first point. A burden on frontline staff has been increased, not eased, by this testdemic and this pingdemic, and now by vaccine injury. Number three, containing and slowing the virus. There's no factual basis to this statement at all. As the previous point about the viral respiratory diseases, it's impossible to contain a viral respiratory disease. Any virologist, immunologist, and scientists will tell you that. They all know this. You cannot contain a viral respiratory disease. So that's nonsense.
No, but you can slow it down, can't you, with a lockdown? You can slow down the spread because people are mingling less.
No, it didn't work. It didn't slow anything down. As I said last week, the studies that have gone into the non-pharmaceutical interventions, so the public health measures that they implemented of lockdown, of restrictions, of quarantines, of curfews, and so on, they had no impact on the spread of the virus. Number four, managing the deceased with respect and dignity. That almost makes me want to vomit, because the number of people who've had the most heartbreaking experiences in the last 18 months of not being able to see, never mind see the deceased, they haven't been able to see their elderly relatives and their loved ones, either in care homes or in the hospital. And they're FaceTiming them in their hour of need and FaceTiming people during funerals and so on. It's been an absolute humanitarian, it's been a hugely traumatic experience.
Alison Pollock, she's a professor or doctor or whatever, but she's a health analyst from Newcastle University, called it barbaric.
It is. It has been barbaric. So again, this fourth point, which the government says that the Coronavirus Act enables them to do, it's sort of Orwellian. It's doing the opposite of what they state in this document. And finally, the fifth one, supporting people. And I suppose the support refers to the financial aid. But they're starting to wind up, you know, they're rolling back that support now. So it seems to me that there is no basis, in fact, for any of their claims. And in fact, most of what they state is the opposite.
I'd add to that, when they say supporting, actually what's happened is tens of thousands of small and medium businesses have had to fold up simply because they couldn't either navigate the bureaucracy of the furlough scheme or support schemes. And totally the opposite is the case for these massive transnational corporations who have quadrupled it and even more their share prices and their market shares.
Right. I mean, small businesses who maybe depend on, in these little Cotswold villages and in Scotland, in the Lake Districts and all these tiny little places that depend on tourism, for instance, they can't suddenly put all their stuff online and start selling all their trinkets and all their tea towels online. No. And the same goes for the catering, the service industry in terms of cafes and tea shops and all the rest of it. It's just, it's an absolute catastrophe. Yeah, it's Orwellian, because everything that the MPs and the talking heads and the Prime Minister states is just sort of Orwellian doublespeak now, it seems to me.
To go back to this repassing the 6 monthly review of the Coronavirus Act, yes, there was a short debate, but it went through without a vote. Just a few people shouting over each other, saying no and yes, and that seemed to be enough for the deputy speaker. But immediately we're hearing bring back COVID rules as cases rise, say NHS chiefs. But the business secretary is saying it's not time for Plan B, which is kind of looming like a sword of Damocles over us. Well, he doesn't say that, I do. And he wants to avoid further lockdowns. So he's saying that we're still on the edge of another lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, it's a psychological war. It's a form of torture, being in a constant state of limbo, Tony. This unrelated, but I kind of experienced this when between the periods of having been arrested in March 2003 and being charged with being arrested on suspicion of breaking the Official Secrets Act, and then not being charged for 8 months until November 2003, that not knowing whether I was going to be charged or not. Although I didn't feel it at the time, it was hugely traumatic. And I think that's what caused a sense of PTSD afterwards, which I never really went into myself. I just let time sort of ease that shock and experience. This is far greater than that. This sense of limbo has extended now for nearly 2 years. And people cannot live comfortably and without stress. when they can't plan, when they can't know for sure that this Christmas they'll be able to spend it with their family. Everything is always up in the air, and it has been since this started. And that is a form of mental torture. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, they're, all of this that they're claiming to do is to protect people against some invisible virus. It's all psychological manipulation, and the rising cases, I think we'll find that, and it's already been pointed out in some, again, alternative media, that the data put out by Office of National Statistics shows that the people who have been vaccinated, either once or twice, or now even a third time, are much more likely to test positive. They're more likely to test positive, and they're more likely to be hospitalized. Now, it's come out in the mainstream media that, you know, it's the unvaccinated who are filling up the hospitals. They don't ever give you any data for that, though. They don't give you any actual proof of that when they make these announcements. You know, the fact that by their definition, a person who is unvaccinated, it doesn't mean that they have not been jabbed. A person who is unvaccinated to them is someone who has only received one jab of a two-jab vaccine, and or they are within 2 weeks of the first or second jab. So basically, they can play with the definitions of who is unvaccinated. The people ending up in hospital 1 week after the jab are basically counted as unvaccinated. So this will skew their figures, right, hugely. And in Australia, coming out in Australia when they make their announcements about how many people have died, supposedly from COVID, it's always 8 out of 10, or sometimes even 10 out of 10, who have been vaccinated. There is a document on the Office of National Statistics website which states how many people have died within 21 days of the first dose, how many have died after 21 days of the first dose, and so on, how many died within 21 days of the second dose, and so on. I suppose you could argue that, well, you can't determine what caused the death of those people if they died within 21 days or even more so after 21 days. But isn't that how they count people who've died from COVID? They count people who've died within 28 days of a positive test. Is that right?
No, in fact, originally, it was if they'd ever had a positive test.
Within 60 days or, you know, as you say, whenever they had a test. So if we wanted to compare like with like and say, okay, this is how we define a person who's died from COVID, then let's also apply that to people who've died following a COVID vaccination. So that, you know, that's what I basically did, and I totted it all up. And this is only from January to beginning of July of this year. The total was 162,000 plus. And why aren't they releasing those sorts of figures? Why don't they say that 30,000 people have died in the past 6 months following the first dose of the vaccine? Why don't they say things like that? Why isn't that being
analyzed? I think this is, in a way, it's one of the biggest questions about the whole business with this COVID plandemic is the complete and utter lack of analysis in all these billion-pound institutions. You know, this is through things like Sky News, the BBC, the Channel 4 News, the Daily Telegraph. There's very little, if any, of this, maybe a little bit in the Mail and the Telegraph, but that seems to be about it. And there does seem to be an absolute and total and utter failure in journalism. You know, obviously journalism is quite important. You know, it's the fourth estate. It's the what we have to have is a check and balance on our democratic institutions. And without it, those institutions do just simply collapse. And we're in the situation now where we have another trial or hearing for Julian Assange, who's someone who's possibly one of the most important investigative journalists or certainly publishers of the last 30 years. Probably since the Iraq war, he's obviously come to prominence. But we're in the situation now where it doesn't actually appear as if he's committed any British crime, and yet he's been incarcerated now for coming on for a decade.
Yes, it's a travesty. And, you know, it's a, again, it's just, it's a terrible joke, really, that, you know, the UK frequently likes to point its fingers at government, at other nations and their political prisoners and their, you know, the lack of freedom of expression and so on in those countries, and accusing them of abusing human rights. You know, it's always a case of the pot calling the kettle black. It's an appalling abuse of power. And this past, I think it was on Sunday just gone, I was on a call, a live Zoom stream that was being recorded, celebrating Craig Murray's 63rd birthday, which he celebrated in prison as well. So he will be coming out, I think, in around the middle of November or end of November this year. And he's been imprisoned for 8 months or so. And he was one of the principal journalists, if you like, who was, I mean, he was a former diplomat, as you know, of Uzbekistan, and ambassador to, British ambassador to Uzbekistan. But he was one of the principal supporters of and investigative reporters for Julian Assange during his trial, and reporting from inside the trial proceedings. So, you know, again, his supporters of Julian Assange, supporters of free speech, government accountability and transparency, they're not celebrated, you know, they're not invited to speak on Channel 4 News and on Newsnight and on BBC Radio 4. These are not people that the status quo want to hear from.
There's something a bit medieval about this. It's almost as if it's an example is being made of somebody who will go down in history as actually a very important figure. And, you know, I hesitate to use the word savior, you know, that sort of thing. But he has done something very important in pointing out some of the absolute lies that we've been being told by, particularly by the United States, but by the UK too, and their role in foreign policy. Well, I say medieval, but we're now in a situation, of course, where the whole world is watching this.
Yes, and I suspect that countries like China and Russia are frankly, well, they're appalled. Simultaneously appalled and perhaps to some extent, I mean, I'm totally projecting here, but perhaps to some extent they're actually a little bit, I don't want to say pleased, but they're, you know, it's sort of a comeuppance that the UK governments, the US government, the Canadian government, the Australian governments are just are actually becoming equally if not more totalitarian and authoritarian than those they accuse of being behaving in such ways.
Yeah, because they're almost handing like a propaganda victory to China, which just seems incredible.
Yeah, I'm having grown up in Taiwan, I'm very partial to Taiwan as an island, as a independent concept, as it were, a country. I understand it's a very complex issue, and I'm not sure I would want to live in China necessarily. But I think the Western understanding of how Chinese society works is very it's only part of the real thing. Imagine, Tony, what is the population of the UK? 80 million. Around about that sort of number. Imagine trying to maintain and sustain and manage a country 2 billion people. I don't think the UK, the US, Canada, they don't have a clue really how a country of the size of China, the size of India, how those countries are able to function effectively. It's another discussion for another day. I don't know enough really about it, but there is definitely now, from the US and from China, US and Canada, and with the UK supporting this anti-China kind of position they're taking, calling this pandemic the Wuhan flu or the China flu, and trying to push the narrative that China started this, and that this is a war by China on the West, and that. Again, that's an inversion of the truth. I think that's a complete, it's another pointing the finger at someone else when, in fact, you're the one that instigated it.
Well, that is easy to say. I mean, we had Sky News Australia's documentary, What Really Happened in Wuhan, out last week, which is an hour-long examination. Apparently, it's taken a year to make the film documentary. They come to the conclusion with Mike Pompeo involved as an interviewee, as well as Richard Dearlove from MI6, saying it's pretty obvious that this is a bioweapon of some sort, that it was certainly man-made. And the Chinese simply tried to cover up the leak from the Wuhan lab.
And you think those people don't have any kind of conflict of interest in these accusations they're making?
Well, one of the things that does strike me as a bit strange is it's very coincidental that we had the World Military Games going on in Wuhan at the same time as this little virus kind of came out through a ventilator at the lab. I mean, there is some evidence that they put forward where they're saying that there was a massive increase in security around September, October at the Wuhan lab. And so it does look as if there may have been some sort of problem there. But the finger is pointing at them. But then they don't really talk in this documentary about the fact that the Pentagon was paying Peter Daszak and the EcoHealth Alliance to do research in this lab. So they're kind of shying away from the idea that perhaps this was something which was a joint project between United States and China. And then the US kind of used that as an attempt to pin the whole thing on China by releasing it there.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, if they're telling the story, they're only telling half of the story. But even if it is a bioweapon, it hasn't been particularly effective in actually increasing all-cause mortality. This latest interview with Dr. Wolfgang Wodak, he actually, you know, and this is a point he's made before. He says, yes, there are these bio labs, and these are, Department of Defense, Ministry of Defense. These are military bio labs. They're nothing to do with public health. And the one in China, it does appear that a few technicians in the laboratory may have died. Two or three or so technicians may have died as a result of these gain of function types of research on various viruses and bacteria and so on. The connection, as he points out in the interview, the connection between that and this pandemic is not there. There does not necessarily have to be any sort of connection. What happened was, at the same time as these deaths occurring, or this kind of laboratory leak, this bit of a, you know, it's a embarrassment, you know, if that came out that they'd had a dangerous leak from a category 4 lab, that it's kind of natural that story would be shut down or tried to be silenced and covered up. It's kind of a natural reaction from any government to want to do that. But then subsequent to that, there was this Christian Drosten character in Germany who overnight almost came up with a PCR test where he basically created a computer modeling of a virus, and then he sent it to Wuhan specifically, where they had ill patients in hospital with pneumonia of some description, and he said, test your patients with this test and see if it is positive. And that's what they did, and hey presto, they were positive. And so from that point onward, they created this story that there is this novel coronavirus and so on. And so the testdemic began. And what we've seen since then is a testdemic. And because this PCR test basically can test for or tests or recognizes any number of coronaviruses, not just SARS-CoV-2, but any number of them, because literally, as Dr. Wodak explains, what they do is they take a tiny snippet of the mRNA or the RNA sequence of these viruses, a snippet out of thousands of pairs of genetic code. And so he likens it to a few words in a book. You know, those same words could appear in any number of books. So are you saying it's A Tale of Two Cities, or are you saying it's Great Expectations, or perhaps it's The Call of the Wild? I mean, who knows which book you're referring to, when it could be any word that you've selected from that book repeated again in other books. And so this is what the PCR test does, and it recognizes any number of coronaviruses and maybe even other viruses, cold viruses and flu viruses. And that's how the whole thing has been created. It's a testdemic and a scamdemic. And the more data that is revealed and the more information that comes out, clearer that picture seems to be.
Well, it is. I mean, it's clear to some of us, you know, the case demic, I've heard some people refer it to it as. You know, symbolic of all of this, complete failure for this clarity to be. In fact, you know, the idea is really that the public is just being dumbed down with lies, deliberate lies, some of it. Others is, you know, putting stupid people who don't understand things out as analysts on the mass media. But it's symbolising all of this is really the plight at the moment, right now, of Julian Assange. And I just wonder if you can finish, Catherine, with just your thoughts about whether he might be freed or not, whether now or ultimately.
I truly hope he is freed. You know, he's already quite, I mean, I can't imagine how deeply traumatized he is at this stage, how his health has been damaged, his physical and mental and emotional health. So really, he's been nailed to the cross, as it were. He's done his time. He shouldn't have even done any time, right? This has been an injustice done to him. And to his family, to his partner, and to his child with her, and to his parents, to his mother and father. It has ripples. It's like a stone in a pond that creates ripples across outwards into the society. The fact that an innocent man who is guilty of nothing is still rotting away in prison creates a sort of collective injury. So the sooner he's out, the better. But I'm afraid the situation now is so dire. Our public officials have told so many lies and are in so deep in these narratives that, I mean, I think they fear, this is what they fear. They fear that they've passed the point of no return now. They cannot row back and save face. They will never be able to save face from this. They will go down in ignominy. And so for them, it's almost like a sunk cost mentality. The past 18, 20 months and the 10 years that Julian Assange has been persecuted, these are sunk costs. They can never be recovered. They see, I think, in order to complete what they set out to do, in order to try and survive this monumental backlash that they would face from the public, is just to plow on regardless. And that's not a pretty outcome at all.
But it is, I mean, it is going to provoke a response, and it is this in the UK. Certainly, there's all sorts of events going on around supporting Julian and people who recognise just what he represents as really a beacon of freedom. That is to say, in intellectually astute, good journalism that calls the establishment and the authorities, the so-called authorities, to account. I mean, it does seem to me that this is also part of a breakdown in leadership, a breakdown in authority, like the sort of things that we saw many, many, you know, centuries ago, and in states that have become tyrannies. But anyway, look, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you, Tony. Speak to you again.